Good morning. Welcome, everyone. I'm Greg Poschman. I'm the chair of the Pitkin County Board of Commissioners. It's my great honor to welcome you to the first Aspen Ideas Health Local Issues session of three this year, a most welcome collaboration between the Aspen Institute and Pitkin County. And I want to thank you for choosing us instead of going powder skiing on the pass this morning. Shakespeare reminds us that brevity is the soul of wit, so I pledge to keep this introduction short so we can get to the program and then on to the questions. But I do have something to say. I want to share our gratitude to begin with for Walter and Elizabeth Pepka, who recognized this special place, committed to it, and created a culture like no other on the planet when they founded the Aspen Institute. Walter is known to have said, quote, "Our remoteness will be an advantage," unquote. I keep that in mind as we contemplate the hard choices we're making in our county. I want to express gratitude to the current Aspen Institute for returning each summer for over 60 years and for connecting us to the universe of ideas and meaning. To the Aspen Institute team who encouraged our joint program, Kitty Boone, Ruth Katz, Killeen Bretman, and then Natalie Johnson, Tracy Anderson, and their staffs who helped make this happen, to our audio crew from CAV, and also to their visionary new president, Dan Porterfield, whose eloquent words on community resilience last summer resonated with us and inspired us in this collaboration. I want to thank the donors who volunteered to cover the hotel rooms for our distinguished guests, and I want to thank our staff, Anna Steinberg and her crew at the library, John Peacock, Charlotte Anderson, and my fellow Pitkin County commissioners. I want to single out today a county staffer, Nan Sundin, who we'll hear from today. Nan has been our driving force, the conscience of our community health for over three decades, and we're so grateful to have her on this panel. And I also want to bring up our star Pitkin County Health Director, Karen Kinneman, who in 2 years has become such an important person in our county and our staff, my co-conspirator and visionary for this program. Affordable housing has become the front and center issue for almost every community around our state and even around the country. We are fortunate in this community in that we have 40 plus years of experience and over 3,000 affordable homes, in contrast to many communities that are just beginning to grapple with an affordable housing crisis. Yet we are challenged to keep improving, innovating, and ensuring the quality of life for all of our citizens. I'm most gratified that in our valley, we can say we have one of the very first climate-responsible, net-zero affordable housing projects nearing completion. That's Basalt Vista down in Basalt. It's a collaboration with the schools down there, Pitkin County, and Habitat for Humanity. So grateful that they're here. And we're going to use that as a model to export responsible, affordable, net zero housing to other communities. Please join us for the conversations on mental health and first responders at 2 p.m. this afternoon, and for the timely and very important panel on the emotional toll of climate change tomorrow at 9 a.m. in this room. Now I'd like to introduce Karen Kinneman, our public health director. Come on up.
Scream at you. I can slide down if you want.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, good morning. Can you hear me in the back of the room?
Good
wonderful. Good so I have the wonderful honor of introducing Dan Porterfield, who is our latest president and CEO of the Aspen Institute. He's been here for about a year now. I hit the ground running. And the first thing I noticed about Dan was his incredible smile. It just beams out of him. And I was trying to get some juicy information to share with you about him from his team, and they said keep it brief. But Dan actually has been, I would say, from reading many articles about you, a social justice warrior for your whole life, and has really been an advocate for immigrant students, for low-income students, for students at risk, and has been a champion in the education community at all levels for his whole life for those who are most marginalized in our communities. And that's really in light of sort of an equity conversation that we're going to be having today, that lens that he can bring is pretty incredible. He also has an amazing bio in which he came to the Institute most recently Franklin and Marshall College, where he was at the college for 7 years as president. He started the Next Generation Initiative Talent Strategy, in which they doubled the number of diverse students in the university over that time that he was there, and low-income students, and again, just been a really big champion for folks. Previous to that, he was at Georgetown University and also was an advocate for immigrant children at that time. He, his wife is in the audience. I don't know. Karen's here, right there. And just learned that you're doing some volunteering for Alpine Legal Services here in our community this summer, which is a wonderful way to provide attorney services for folks who need it in this community. So I'm keeping this brief, but good. Yeah. So thank you, Dan, for your vision, and your staff is just really thrilled to have you here as well. So,
yeah. Thank you, Karen. We're not passing the mic. All right, thank you. Thank you, Karen. Thank you, Greg, and all of you for being here. The Aspen Institute is super proud of our home and home base in Aspen, Colorado, and the way that our institution and the community as a whole, the city, the Roaring Fork Valley, are what Shakespeare would have called a marriage of true minds, always working together, always trying to find the next edge that we can move towards together to make a difference for all people. I always think with a special emphasis on those who are most vulnerable. And one of the great opportunities that we have is to come together and convene every year through our ideas festivals and to start to frame the issues of the day in ways that lead us to take action tomorrow. I really love that idea of ideas leading to action. And we have some great leaders here with whom to have a conversation. We all know that affordable housing is a crisis here and everywhere. That then plays out in all sorts of ways, in health for sure. All kinds of problems in health would be prevented if people had housing security, if they had income security. Similarly, educational issues are often magnified. The so-called opportunity gap plays out in significant ways when kids don't have the opportunity to pursue their education because they don't have housing stability, or their parents don't have resources to invest in books or in summer opportunities, or in all the things you need to have a student feel comfortable, secure, when learning. We've learned a lot, in fact, about the impact of stress on students at early ages and how the kinds of stress that come with poverty can really lead to all sorts of blocks and barriers to students that are preventable if we could just sort of get it all together and try to provide a stable, secure housing and neighborhood environment for our children. So these are big themes, and probably every community in the world in some way or another should be thinking about this. But here we have a particular challenge, I think, because the affordable housing crisis is a crisis for lower-income people, but also for middle and moderate-income people, I think. And it's probably a growing crisis. One study that I read about said that we can expect to be about 5,700 units short by the year 2027. And you know, we got a little bit of time to work on that, but we're short right now. So it's a problem today is going to get worse. It's almost certain to. And on the other hand, if we can learn from people that have made a difference, understand the issues, learn from others, we can also have that feeling of community pride and hope that comes from moving forward. So with that, we have three leaders that I have a chance to interview today. And I thought I'd ask roughly, you know, 30 minutes of questions and then get it open. My principle is always to ask short questions so that you can give short answers so we can get some momentum, the audience get involved, and we have a great time. And let me just quickly introduce our three. We have Nan Sundin on the far left. You all know the legend, Director of Human Services for Pitkin County. Had a great chance to meet in the spring, and your presentation that day was fantastic. The whole room was galvanized. And thank you, Nan. And then we have Shirley Franklin, the former mayor of Atlanta, a person that made a huge impact in that role, but then didn't go retire, but rather became the CEO and now the executive chairman of Purpose Built Communities, which we're going to learn a little bit about if you want to get this feeling of inspiration for what we can do here. And then we have Nita Mosby Tyler, the founder and chief catalyst of the Equity Project in Denver. And besides doing many big things in her career, she drove across the mountains at 4 a.m. in the dark in order to be here. So, way to go. So if she can do that, we can definitely stay awake, ask strong questions, and be ready to have a good time. So let's start it off with Nan. Will you set the context a little bit for Pitkin County? Kind of who lives here? How do you think about this issue of the affordable housing crisis?
Sure. We're in the most beautiful place on the planet, right? Amazing. We have about 18,000 residents. About 25% of our population lives at or below 200% of poverty. Is there an echo or is it just me? Is that a... It's okay for you? I'm like... Okay. When I think about our affordable housing crisis here, what we know is that there's a lack of units. There's a lack of affordability. We have a great set of over 3,000 units. There's a lot of debate about whether they're affordable. And we have a seasonal resort economy here. And so we have a population of people who are overeducated and underemployed, and they're not making enough to make a livable wage. The state of Colorado has the self-sufficiency standard where they determine in every county based on food, housing, transportation, medical costs, and sort of a miscellaneous, they measured every county in the cost of living, and it costs 2 to 4 times here in Pitkin County what it does anywhere else in the state. And so with that, housing costs are too high. People are spending over 30 to 50% of their income on housing. They have to decide between housing, food, and insurance. We have the highest rate of uninsured in the state, and the current figure is 19% uninsured, and that is a lot because of the lack of affordability of insurance and the choices that people have to make around basic needs of housing and insurance.
Yeah. Yeah, so there's a lot to unpack there. But I do want to tease out from everyone, what are some of the health implications in particular when you have to spend so much money on housing, or when you're in housing that itself is not secure? Yeah. So that's all implicit in everything you just said, that this is a health problem.
Right, and we thanks to Karen and the West Mountain Regional Health Alliance, we've been studying the health impacts and what through a survey that was done by the Regional Housing Authority. So what we know is that housing instability is a state of being on the threshold of falling into crisis.
Yeah.
As a result of stressors, the financial stressors, mental health stressors, a sense of safety and crime stressors. All of that level of stress is impacting health.
Yeah, we know it. So let me ask maybe Shirley and then Nita, as you hear Nan's overview, does it sort of, are there some lessons you've learned from your work that may be relevant to the kinds of challenges that Nan just presented?
So thank you. Setting the framework. I mean, America generally has a housing crisis. I think you said that, and the crisis probably is. I don't know as much about rural areas, but I suspect that it's there as well as in urban areas. In urban areas, we've determined that there are about 800 neighborhoods in urban areas that are at the breaking point in terms of the social determinants of health because of poverty. It's not a scholarly work, it's work done by our own staff, but using census data. And so we believe one of the reasons that we did that research is to say that this, we know where the problem is, and therefore we have a start at doing something about it. And so our work says that you use the neighborhood unit. And Nan laughed when I said that the other day. But a smaller unit, deep dive into a smaller unit where you actually address all of the issues through strategic planning and infrastructure development, kind of the human infrastructure and physical human infrastructure that you need. using the neighborhood unit. So purpose-built communities started this a little over 20 years ago. One of the architects is sitting in the audience, Carol Naughton, who's the president of purpose-built. She and others said, what can we do about the worst, most impoverished, highest, lowest performing school, the highest crime rate, lowest employment rate? That neighborhood in Atlanta is called Eastlake. If you came today, you would say, no way. Because over 20 years, a small group of people, Carol and three other people, got together, a housing authority executive director, who we have here today, a philanthropist, and a resident. And they designed a model that is three parts. Mixed income rental housing to serve the lowest need people, the lowest income people, those who are at the 30% or below in terms of income level. Introduce a great school. Maybe you already have great schools. I don't know. But in this case, it was the lowest performing school of 69 schools and had been for a long time. And it was underpopulated, which meant the cost of operating the school was higher because you really didn't have the number of students that you needed. And none of the and teacher turnover was high. So create a great school. Started as a K to 5, expanded to a K to 8. Still nobody in the city wanted to come because they knew their history. Went back down to 6 weeks old and then expanded to 12th grade. So we now have almost 2,000 children in that school, having started with 300, and it is in the top two or three schools in the entire district, but the top school for African-American children. We have 60% or 50% or more free and reduced lunch in the state of Georgia. That's in 20 years. So that's the good news. And then a collection of services and programs, some of which are related to health and access to health, around community wellness, all coordinated by what we call a community quarterback. Now, I'm an arts person, so I'm always looking for a better description of that organization. So let's just, but it is a community quarterback. Mm-hmm. And not a conductor. Mm-hmm. And that organization is dedicated just to that neighborhood. And it includes people from across the city. They develop strategic plans. They bring their own resources. They work through all the issues that it takes to transform a community from the worst to one of the best to live in. And all of the metrics show a huge change in that community over time. And so I'll finish on this. The question is, do you still serve low-income people? The answer is yes, because we built the housing and we built the school around the mission to serve them first and to serve them in a way that would attract middle-income people and other investors. It's a little different model.
Let me ask one quick follow-up, and then I'll go to Nita. So purpose-built communities. It almost sounds when you speak that because you're a mayor, you're talking about the government being able to do it. But what you've done is through purpose-built communities. And what is that organization?
It's a not-for-profit. We are pro bono. Someone pays for us, yes. We have three donors that pay our salaries. We have about a little under a $5 million budget, 15 people, wide range of backgrounds. Carol is a former real estate attorney. Our CEO is a former Boston Consulting Group consultant. And what we do is go into communities who invite us. And we help them figure out how to take the resources they have, the dreams that they have, and use the experience we have over 20 years to model a not just a good project, but a sustainable project, a financially sustainable project, a community sustainable project that will continue to grow and improve over time. So we started with one. We have 23 now. I don't know which is closest to you, but we're in Texas. Is that too far?
That's close. That's close.
Omaha, Nebraska. We're in Omaha, and they're about to start their second initiative, and often funded initially by a Family Foundation that's interested in getting engaged in a more transformative initiative. So we're really excited about it. Our founder, who is a developer and now a full-time philanthropist, he expects us to be everywhere. And we are trying to get there, but we usually add one, two or three new network members every year. So look us up, Purpose Built Communities. We're glad to talk to you today or any other time.
Thank you. Awesome. Nita, tell us about the Equity Project, and then if there's some lessons learned from your work that could be relevant for Pitkin County.
Sure. The Equity Project started out of my desire to tackle what I was seeing happen in 2016 around the presidential election and our community starting to polarize in our ability to talk to one another. And so my assumption was we are not going to advance systems of equity. We won't be able to tackle affordable housing and all of these things that make a difference in our communities if we can't talk. So the design of the Equity Project really is about pulling people together in a collective to talk about things that have been historically difficult, like race and economics and all of those sorts of things that drive inequities in our country. That was the formation of the Equity Project. So I'm based out of Denver. I travel the country in this work, and I try to provide frameworks and ways for people to think about the already wonderful work that they're doing. And so I just have a couple of things that I would add to Nan and Shirley's comments, and here's the first one that'll either depress you or inspire you, I'm not sure. And that is for us to just remember that in the United States of America, we have never had a system of equity before. None of our systems were built with equity in mind, not education, not housing, not transportation, not the justice system, not healthcare. They just weren't. So a piece of what we're tackling right now is the fact that we are all in our collective work trying to advance systems of equity and systems that weren't built for that. And not only that, there's no playbook for how you're supposed to do it. And that also makes this complicated. And so as you think about the topics that we're on right now, I do want you to think about, as much as we're working really hard to make the it happen, this is in many ways a dismantling of systems that were not designed to do exactly what you're working on right now. So that's one thing I want you to think about. The other thing to think about with housing in particular, and I hear this across the country, there is a lack of housing and there is a lack of affordable housing. Mm-hmm. And those aren't the same thing. I live in Denver, I can tell you there's not a lack of housing. Mm-hmm. There's a lack of affordable housing. And so our explicitness in saying what we mean will matter a great deal in the advancement of equity. And then lastly, I'll say this. To remember that there are tentacles in all of these inequities that we're working on that tie every single one of our systems together. So if you are doing explicit housing work and you're not thinking about those other social determinants, what you're probably doing will be a temporary moment in time solution. The entire system of inequity in our country is beautifully, I'm being sarcastic, woven with other systems and their inequities. And we know that. We know that systems of housing segregation and systems of school segregation came together. So we know that those kind of things exist. And so at the foundation of all of those things, all of those tentacles from one system to another, comes a foundation of health inequity that it sits on top of. Yep. And so we have some things that over time have caused real physiological health issues. I think about my dad a lot, who had his first heart attack at age 36 and was dead by age 51. And what he had to work through in these systems of oppression and inequity that I know were factors to that. We also know that there are some things that are not physiological, like infant mortality rates in the African American community, that has not been related to anything but toxic stress due to racism. We also have those sorts of factors that we're talking about now. So, long story short, We have to begin to think about the implications of all systems to one another in our solution making. And the other foundational piece is, what are the health issues that we can straight line link to all of those systems of inequity that we're working on?
So that, what a comprehensive way to think about it. Thank you so much. And I feel like, as a person doing education reform, I've sometimes felt exactly what you said, exactly. And for me, one of the, I guess, riddles of it all is how to make practical progress with that critique at the starting point. And is there work you're doing then that can use that critique in a way that you've been able to see progress being made?
Yeah, I think what I can say to you really mirrors with what Shirley just said, is I think as much as we want to solve big problems, sometimes the best work is in smaller, piloted, proximal sorts of projects. So depending on the sector that I'm working in, we try to create laboratories to model what systems of equity look like. And so I know that our go-to position is just to fix the thing that's bleeding right now. That makes plenty of sense to me. But to actually create a system of equity, we're going to have to capsulize what we're doing into smaller chunks, I think, and model what it looks like. And so I'll just give you a quick example. This isn't a housing one, but you'll follow my point here. Before I started the Equity Project, I was the Senior VP of HR and Chief Inclusion Officer at Children's Hospital Colorado. We had a desire to model what a system of equity would look like, health equity. So we took a department and decided that we would create what a system of equity would look like, knowing that we'd never seen one before. It took us about 8 months, me and an oncologist and a surgical team and everybody that worked in that department, to design what would it look like if you pulled racism out of a system, oppression out of a system, what would you be designing? And that's what we did. We designed the system that had the right people in it, the right processes in it, the right relationships that were reciprocal between patient families, and practitioners. We designed it. And so in many ways, I think those kind of models are what I always try to recommend people do, to carve out a little test case in it, little laboratory to design it first before you scale it out to a whole community.
So in that model, what changed because of what you did?
So we saw health outcomes change. As a matter of fact, we saw more patients come in because they felt that they could have their needs met. And then we saw relationships between patient families, and clinicians change because of those relationships. And then systems that were not even in the practice before were in the practice. Language sorts of remedies were in the practice. We saw people be able to interpret what practitioners were saying to them differently because the system changed for them.
Awesome. Thank you. Mm-hmm. All right, so now,
I would just add, so we started in Atlanta. And for several years, literally thousands of people came to Atlanta because they heard Tom Cousins talk about the transformation of the neighborhood. And he was very excited, as was Carol and other people who were involved. At that point, I was not engaged. And each of them came and said, we want to do the same thing. So we were just doing the Eastlake Foundation, one community, one school, one set of housing, you know. And he got frustrated, as did everyone else, because people went back to their cities that had very similar issues in neighborhoods, and they started, and they come back and say, well, we're just going to do the school, or we're just going to do the housing, or we're just going to give up. So after a few years, that's why he formed purpose-built communities, because he brilliantly saw that what people needed was some coaching. They needed people with experience. Now, that sounds like all of a sudden we would be in business and everybody would want us, right? Well, the phones rang. But it really wasn't until the last 4 or 5 years when the entire national discussion has changed from point solutions to system solutions and neighborhood solutions. We all opened the paper and read David Brooks say, neighborhoods are the unit of change that we need to look at. We were like, yes, this is terrific. Now we have someone who's not doing anything about this, who has recognized exactly what you've said, that you can start someplace instead of fretting about the fact that you can't start every place. And I really wouldn't, that's totally not related to my mayoral or public service, yeah, because I would have had a very hard time saying that as a mayor. Although the yeah, mayor of Mesa said that yesterday at the panel, that he was willing to do that. But 15 years ago, if I had told anybody in Atlanta that I was going to work in one neighborhood, I probably wouldn't have run re-election,
yeah,
because it was unpopular.
Yeah.
But the time is now to make these system changes, yeah, that Nita has described. And the place is here. Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
one thing I'm really excited about is hearing the two of you speak is that you've created, this may not be the perfect word, but these intermediary organizations that can come in and help people, mm-hmm, express their goals and their hopes and organize themselves so that they can start to make a difference. And sometimes it takes that, a caring and experienced catalyst, community respectful, engaged and driven to help a community find its assets and put it together. So thank you for sharing both those. So now, Nan, not that you're in charge of figuring out what can we do here, but as you hear these comments, could the kinds of approaches, yeah, that we're hearing from Shirley and Nita, is there potential? Have we tried versions of this here in the past?
Yeah, I think I know. I didn't laugh when you said neighborhoods. I was opening my mind to that because I think we're doing that already on some, yeah, levels. So, I mean, there's a lot going on around housing. It's scattered. We need to kind of put our arms around it and pull it together and be intentional, I think. These are my personal opinions.
Yeah.
The county is buying units all over, right? The city is looking at APSHA 300 more units. We have a housing stability coalition with over 100 members of public, private, nonprofit, faith, participants who are looking at a continuum of care to stop housing instability, to prevent it, and then to have resources when people find themselves experiencing homelessness. And I think that, the county just recently bought a mobile home park,
yeah,
with the idea of taking one neighborhood and trying to protect the affordable housing on it so that the two monster homes don't go up on it, right? And then going into the community and having discussions about what the community wants. So I feel like we're doing it. We're partially involved in the models and not, and I think that we have so many advantages here. We have a really tight community. We generally like each other and agree with each other on a lot of things. We have a great school system. We have a great hospital. We have an awesome police and law enforcement. We're all working together around a lot of things. We've been successful making and ensuring access for health with a federally qualified health center. We've done that around mental health, although there's some big changes. We can talk about that another time. But we can do this around housing. We can take, we need help, and we need to coordinate our efforts. We need to be intentional, but this is a problem we can solve. And just an example, one of our committee members for the Housing Stability Group said, I've been doing real estate for years. They're never gonna be able to deal with the empty homes that are in this community. It's never gonna happen. It's never gonna happen. And I just disagree with that. I think the more we talk about it, the more opportunity comes up. And our second homeowners are extraordinarily generous in this community. And I heard someone at a presentation yesterday say, it was the Mesa mayor, said gentrification was our problem and it is also part of our solution. And we need to get our minds around working together.
Yep. Before I open it up to questions, Nan, one other question for you, partly because this is a health festival, is your read of the health needs of young people in this area, in the Roaring Fork Valley, just an overview of that. There's surely very different health outcomes among those that have extraordinary financial privilege and those that don't. But could you just give a little bit of a flavor for what our youth are dealing with right now?
that our youth are dealing with the same things that Shirley's and Meeta's are, right? There's a high rate of anxiety and depression. There's a social disconnect. There's a sense of missing out. There's racial oppression in our community. There are silent populations that don't have a voice. There's a lot going on, and I think that it, in our community, this is the only thing I can relate to, is that I believe the economic pressure, the housing instability, the food insecurity is impacting our children dramatically and making this an insecure world.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. So thoughtful. Let me open it up to the group that's here. Any questions for any of our panelists? All the way in the back.
Good morning. My name is Michelle Leek. I'm with the Colorado Health Institute. Nita, great to see you. Nan, same to you. It's really nice to meet you. I have a question about solving these problems in a valley that's so resource intensive as the Roaring Fork Valley. And how do we solve problems like the ones that you've had described without being patronizing and making sure that we're solving these issues of housing from a lens of equity and not something else?
So part of our approach is not just solving the problem, but preventing it. So I think you have to be on two tracks. You know, you're solving a problem, but a big part of your energy is going to be on preventing it. And my experience in community development, separate in addition to it, purpose-built, just as a public official, is that most people that I've ever worked with, regardless of their backgrounds or really the nature of their problems, they want to prevent that problem for their children and their family members, even if they're willing to live with it themselves. So I would ask that when you ask that question, you ought to at least think about not just solving a problem, but how do you prevent it? Because the sustainability issue is very important. Public housing solved a problem at the time it was built in most urban communities. But it wasn't sustainable as a solution. And it's only recently modified to be in this new era of mixed income and community-based, place-based development. That should have happened in the 60s, instead of in 2000 and 2010. So we are we were so busy trying to solve the problem of housing, we forgot that that was no longer the problem. So the preventable piece is an important piece. That doesn't answer your question. It kind of adds to it, really.
I'm
a mayor. What can I tell you?
I don't know if the question is loaded, but the topic is loaded, right? Because we in Picken County are often tagged as being that wealthy community. They have so many resources, they don't need us, or there isn't enough of a need. We can't compete with some of the Southeast poverty numbers, right? The population. But we have our own story. And I think that we need to be working together more with foundations around what this story is and finding the solution where our most vulnerable clientele is. The only second thought, totally separate, is that in 2012, Aspen and Picken County had a joint housing summit, it was called. And we presented, I was part of presenting, the idea of supportive housing and trying to prevent evictions and homelessness and housing insecurity. The focus here is on something that everyone considers workforce housing. And I think that it's Rachel Richards who's really starting to change the narrative to community housing. And that our people who are housing insecure are working, right? And so how do we take our most vulnerable population and make it livable for them to make it attractive for the other income levels and other abilities.
I add just one thing to what you both said, too, is the sustainability piece, the solving a problem in a moment in time, also forces us to really pay attention to our language over time, too. I mean, I just think about words like low income. We know what that is, and it's a real thing. However, when people that you're describing hear that, it automatically stratifies them very different in the community, and their behavior works accordingly. And so a part of what I think, too, as we're building these new structures for sustainability, we also need to think about what we're going to call all of these things, and are we using the most empowered language to make that happen? That will mean everything in the framework of health as well.
And sustainability.
Yeah.
Because the idea is, our idea is that you're trying to break the cycle.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. So that you're not going, those words are useless mm-hmm. when you get to that point, but you're really trying to change the frame.
Yeah.
One of the strengths of the Aspen Institute is that we have a whole array of programs that are headquartered in Washington, D.C., that focus on key issues, like the changing nature of work, or like the needs of Native American youth, or like the needs of public school systems to be able to attract the teachers and the resources to be able to provide the best quality education, on and on. And something that, to answer your question, try that one more time. Something to answer your question that I've learned from my colleagues in D.C. who are working with opportunity youth or who are working in areas where they're participating in an effort not to be condescending is that there's sort of like a triangle that I've seen my best colleagues in D.C. that they've developed as their approach. And it must come out of a deep commitment to progress and impact. Can't just be talk, but then within that, co-creation, meaning anyone working with us is in a partnership relationship with those mm-hmm. we seek to help, which requires the sharing of power and the openness to a longer process of strategic development rather than the quickest action possible to build the relationships, the partnerships, the learning, and that the learning is on our side, those that would be the helpers. We really need to slow down and engage and co-create. That's one part. The second part is that in working with many partners on, say, Opportunity Youth, we work with groups that work with Opportunity Youth all around the country to create a community of practice so that we're embedded in a network of others trying to make a difference. That's one of the best things about our convenings in that setting is we're convening practitioners that are in there so they can learn together. That second part, co-create, community of practice. And then the third part is systems change, that as we're working together, sharing power, open to new approaches, connecting those that are working on different issues but towards the same big picture, that we're learning things. We're learning about structures and systems that if we have to change them or we're going to be putting Band-Aids on the problems. And it's such a great feeling for the communities that we're partnering with when their experience is honored so that the barriers to their having the lives they're ready to create can be addressed as well as
right.
partnering to get that specific solution. And it's, you know, it's a triangle though. And if you get, I believe, if you get communities involved as partners and you constantly build that community of practice, then to act to change the structural barriers becomes almost the joyful exercise of putting our shared learning together into the service of an agenda that's a little bit larger, maybe political or structural. And it can really feel great. And this is just me translating what my colleagues who don't work here, they work in D.C., what they're doing on some of the issues. And yet, even as I say that, I see this place-based philosophy that you've been able to express that to me is like the next
yeah.
great
mm-hmm.
thing. next question, all the way in the far back.
Thank you, Greg Hammer. I live here in the summertime. Love it here. It's heaven on earth, especially when you're from Miami, otherwise, in the summertime. Miami, also known as a ground zero for the economic impacts of sea level rise, climate gentrification, an issue down there. Those who don't know what's happening is that the Po folks, the black folks who were not allowed to go on the Miami Beach historically, are on higher ground. Now that's valuable land, and they're being pushed out. So that's a big issue in South Florida. Climate gentrification, something, it's a new term for some people. It's a big thing in South Florida. My question is broader based, and I loved what you had to say, Anita. It spoke to me number of times. You talked about the systemic effects and dealing with trying to reach for systemic solutions. Meanwhile, we play whack-a-mole with linear solutions to problems, band-aids, like Dan said. And in fact, Madam Mayor, you alluded to the fact that certain programs are just not sustainable, because sometimes when the subsidy money goes away, the program goes away. That's not sustainable, right? So I want to. My volunteer work is at the nexus of climate, economics, or the economy, and society. Yeah. And I want to know, to what degree have you thought about, anybody, but really, Nita, the fact that at the root of a lot of this, and I come from green building, and I got out of it because it's not just, the demand isn't there. We push upstream, we swim upstream, we celebrate exceptions, and they're oftentimes not sustainable. That flow that we're up against is underpriced fossil fuel. I wanted to what degree, and many people believe that that's the overarching umbrella under which a lot of the other systems exist and struggle. And oftentimes we ignore that while playing whack-a-mole, and we fight for the exceptions. We celebrate the exceptions, but we sometimes ignore that as an overarching one of the many systemic issues that we sometimes don't like to talk about. Does that land on your radar? And I'd love to hear what you have to say about this.
It does land on my radar, and it is actually the way I articulate the work that either makes people very happy or very not happy when I say this. I do think that there are opportunities to dismantle systems, but we don't talk like that in our country. We don't talk in terms of equity. When we talk about things that we think are equity, we're doing pieces of the solution, not the actual dismantling of the system that causes the inequities in the first place. So I actually think there are two bodies of work. I think there are heavy bodies of work with a design on equity, creating systems where everyone thrives, where you are dismantling a system. And then I think there are other things that are designed to chip away at inequity. Some of those things that are designed to chip away at inequity are shorter term solutions. And so I think if we start to look at our work and categorize them, is this the dismantling one that is systemic in nature? Is this the one that really is important but is not going to be sustainable, might not be funded long term, but chips away at an inequity? Is the best way to look at the work. And I think it keeps people engaged and more hopeful in the work when we stratify the work in that way. We have a lot of people across the state that are doing the chipping away piece, and we need it. Boots on the ground stuff. I'm chipping away. I'm not really dismantling a system, but I'm offering solution for something that's real time and urgent. Then we've got people that are concentrated, probably people like you, people like me, that are looking at systems that we're trying to unravel and dismantle because they make all of the chipping away activities moot if we don't get at those. So that's how I look at the work. That's how I do the work, and that's how I articulate it.
Nope. Next question, please. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Tom Cirillo, and I work as an advisor for the Diatribe Foundation, which is working in the diabetes realm to improve people's lives. And one of the big issues we're addressing is largely around affordable housing and access to healthy food and food deserts. And health, obviously, from that. And I don't know the Aspen community that well, how much that plays a role, but I'm certainly interested in hearing from all of you, but in particular, Mayor Franklin, how that works in the neighborhoods you're working in. Are there food deserts? How big a role? Is that something that's
important?
It's a huge
role.
Great question.
So Eastlake hadn't had any new developments for 40 years prior to the start of this work 20 years ago. And it took an awful lot to get a first-class grocery store in the neighborhood, and our philanthropist was very frustrated. I mean, Tom was very frustrated for 5 or 6 years. The foundation bought land and held it, assuming that we could attract that. So we went from no grocery store, you know, like just little corner stores, which have their place, but not as the primary location. And therefore, also the grocery store provides employment, which is important for the community. To having the third most successful grocery store in, you know, a 20-mile radius. Because a philanthropist bought the land and held it, mm-hmm. buy the land, hold it, build affordable housing, and the result changed the neighborhood. They're now walking. And they're now walking to the grocery store instead of borrowing money or jumping in somebody else's car, taking a cab or a Lyft or whatever. That's one thing. But the second, but there were no sidewalks, so you had to build those too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In addition to that, looking at what was being served in the school and whether there are community gardens and overlapping all of that. The advantage of a comprehensive approach is there's room for all of that. There is no community that we're working on that is not building in health mm-hmm. options, mm-hmm. including reasonably priced, high quality grocery stores. We're not building the highest end, but we're building stable, successful community stores.
Mm-hmm. Next question. Let me thank all in the library for being here. You know, the ASP Institute is all about building networks of values-driven leaders working to make positive change. This is values-driven leaders working to make positive change in stunning human form. Thank you, all three.
Thank you. Thank you.